This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is indeed Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, joined by, well, the pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld. Haven't heard him on this program with me in a while, and it's nice to have him back in the mix here on Trainer Talk. And JT, we're coming to our listeners from the Phasic Tipton sales grounds in Saratoga Springs, New York, and we want to extend a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and everybody listening worldwide with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. And very happy to have you with us, and we've had the privilege of visiting with so many of the biggest names in the game, Baffert, Mandela, Bill Mott, Todd Pletcher, Jack Van Berg, and tonight, JT, we welcome yet another legendary name.
Oh, this is so fantastic. Just really excited to do this show. I was like a little kid this morning. I told everybody I knew, and just very, very pleased to have our special guest here today.
Yeah, we want to thank the folks here at Phasic Tipton for helping to organize this very special show for you here tonight. And we are going to visit with trainer Gay Waterhouse, who was born in Scotland, but she was raised in Sydney. She was inducted into Australia's Racing Hall of Fame in 2007 after just 15 years of training horses. And she's often referred to as the First Lady of Australian racing. She has trained more than 130 Group 1 winners. She ranks third all-time behind only her father, the legendary Hall of Famer T.J. Smith, and trainer Bart Cummings in that particular category. And we do welcome Gay Waterhouse to Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton here tonight. Gay, thank you so much for being with us. It's an absolute delight.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Jude, for having me here today. It's a real pleasure. You know, I wasn't born in Scotland.
Oh, it wasn't Scotland. Oh, so that was misinformation.
I know. It's on Wikipedia. But the funniest thing is,
we need to update that Wikipedia page.
Exactly. I was in England with Bentley Biscuit, a horse I had over there for Ascot about 8 years ago, and I'm a bit hard of hearing. And the man interviewing me had a very strong Scottish accent. And when the interview started, I could feel myself sweating profusely and thinking, oh, my God, I couldn't understand a word he said. So I just said yes to everything. So, yes, I'm born in Scotland.
When someone mentions all of those lofty numbers, 130-plus Group 1 winners, and you hear your name with your dad's name and with Bart Cummings, what goes through your head? What goes through your mind?
Firstly, it's nice to be up there with them because they're the best of the best. You know, TJ was Australasia's greatest champion trainer, and Bart Cummings, champion trainer and winner of 12 Melbourne Cups. Could you imagine to win 12 Breeders' Cup Classics or whatever? I mean, he's a remarkable trainer.
And all of that winning has only made Gay Waterhouse want to win even more, right?
It does make you keener because you can't rest on your laurels, can you? You've got to keep focusing forward all the time.
You have countless clients and lots of horses, but you seem to always tailor-make your training program to the horse. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, Jude, I've got quite a number of horses under my care, and they're like, people say, oh, how can you remember them? How can you do this? How can you do that? Well, I make it my business, and all I think about them are my horses, and, you know, my children often say to me, you know, Mum, you think more about the horses than us, and I'm very much juggling with my family and as any woman who's working in a business and happens to have a family and children, but the biggest thing is that they're all individual, and what Mike wants and what Jude wants might be two different things. So as a trainer, I'm a bit like the head of an all-girls school or a boarding school. That's probably closest to it. And these are my boarders. You know, we make up the beds or a hotel. I say it's like a boutique hotel, and the clients send me their horses. I've got to have their beds made, and I've got to have them fed and looked after and exercised. That's my job.
What's the key to balancing the home life and the training life, Kay? How do you do it?
Well, it's a lot easier now because my number one priority, of course, is my husband. It always has been. But and my children have, you know, I used to make sure I was home in the morning. They Rob would be there to send them off to school. I'd be home every afternoon to make sure when they were there and they came home, I was there for them. And we ate with them every night. We sat down. We took the telephone. That was in the days where you take the receiver off because they're now 30 and 31, so they're growing up with family themselves. But we'd take the receiver off and we'd sit down and have a meal with them every night. So if there was going to be an issue, inverted commas, it'd usually come up at the dinner table, sometimes in fisticuffs, sometimes on, but, you know, it comes out, doesn't it? Right. And I think that's very important. I think it's very important. Talk about having your horses under your nose. I think it's very important to have your kids under your nose. And, you know, there's too much of going into their rooms and eating their dinner while they're playing on the computer. I think that's a real problem. I really do. So, you know, I'm a bit of an old-fashioned in that respect.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. When you're in that process in the family situation, sometimes the kids don't understand. Mom has to go to the track. She has to go run her horses today, and they have an activity or something. You're not going to be there, and it can create some issues. But I think as they get older, they kind of learn that, you know, what you do is important, and they start participating. Do your kids enjoy the sport? Are they into it, or are they like, I don't want to be involved?
No, they've both been brought up. My husband, Rob, is a bookmaker. And in Australia, you know, bookmakers are on track. They're not off course. They're on track. The TAB, which is your like the betting here, is off track. So Tom and Kate heard us talking horse all the time. That was our conversation. We enjoy talking horse. Tom's a bookmaker. He's the head of William Hill, the bookmaking firm in Australia. He's recently been appointed there. And Kate is a blogger. She's a fashion blogger. And she's married with a little girl, Sophia, and she seems to be very happy and very, very good at what she does. She has a column in our number one paper on a Sunday, Date with Kate.
Did they ever consider following in your footsteps the way you followed in your father's footsteps?
They both worked in the stables where they helped me on a Sunday because we opened the stables for the owners on a Sunday, and they'd both come and help me, you know, lead out the horses or sweep the yard or do things like that. They both rode their ponies, but Tom said at a very early age, Mummy said it's too much hard work and not enough money, so he said you're in the wrong business.
Well, I mentioned following in your father's footsteps. Your father, Tommy Smith, a Hall of Fame trainer in his own right, legendary. When you first started to kind of go down that road and say, Dad, I want to follow you. I want to be a horse trainer. It had to be difficult with some of the expectations that must have been placed on you.
Well, I was Dad's foreman or, you know, assistant for about 10 years. And one night over dinner, I'll never forget it. We were sitting there, Rob, Dad and Mum and myself. And I said, look, I want to take out my license. And he said, what do you want to do that for? He said, you're good doing what you do. He said, you're great as my PR and PA and P everything. And I said, look, I can do that with my eyes shut. I want to do something a bit more substantial. I want to be able to train like you do. And he said, no, it's too hard, Gay. He said, it's just too hard. He said, you don't want to do it. Anyway, there was a blazing row took place. And I, of course, stupid me, stormed off. And Dad said to Rob, go and talk to her. The next day, typical my father, he rang up and he said, if you're going to be a horse trainer, you apply for a number one license. He said, because you've got to price yourself at the top. And he said, you've got to be able to, because he said, you won't be able to move your costings after that. He said, you've got to set to and get on with it. He was very supportive. And he got me my first group horse, Tiako Nick. The owner, David Ellis, rang him up from New Zealand and said, you know, I want to send you Tiako Nick. He's just won the guineas here. Tommy, I'd like you to train him. He said, oh, no. He said, Gay's a much better trainer. Well, I didn't even license him. He said, she's a much better trainer. And he said, she should be training. Well, that won the Metropolitan, the 2,600-meter race, my first group won. I wouldn't have got it without my dad. So it was fantastic.
Wow. What was it about your dad that made him such a good trainer?
Oh, he had his horses fit. He used to go and buy them at the sale, and, you know, when he bought Tullock, which is Australia's greatest horse, I mean, people forget this horse, you know, this is back in the early 60s, you know, Tullock won from the Breeders' Plate, which is 1,100 metres to 2 miles. And he backed up, and he was off the scene for a year and a half, dying, you know, and he resurrected him. I mean, Dad was had his horses fit. People used to say, oh, Tommy's too hard on them. Tommy wasn't hard on them at all. He had them fit, and they performed. You don't win 33 consecutive premierships if you don't have your horses fit.
Well, he obviously gave you the right cues to go on with your career. And it's such a legacy that you two have. I mean, this is like unheard of, really, in our business. Like in the United States, a lot of trainers' sons and daughters try it, but they don't really seem to emulate their fathers the way that you have. So you must have been a tremendous student of what he did.
I had nothing to lose, in a way, in that you know, I was lucky enough to be the daughter of a man who'd made it. He'd come from very humble beginnings, and he'd been able to give me the best education and the best life. But I just wanted, through pure love, to show my dad that I could do it, not let him down. So I suppose I was driven by something different. But look, that's what he said early. It's hard. And I think it's very difficult for sons and daughters to try to follow, even especially if their fathers or mothers have been great. It must be terribly difficult, you know. Hillary Clinton's daughter must find. I mean, everyone, you know, when you've had famous parents or successful parents, it's very difficult. You know, there's certain expectations on you. Well, there were none because I was a woman. And at the same time, about 4 or 5 young guys took out their licenses. But I just want to show Dad that I could do it. Not, hey, you're wrong and I'm right. Just that he would be proud of me, that he would say, look, I'm really pleased that she's done well. Now, that's what I wanted to prove, you know.
I noticed on your website they refer to you as a lady trainer. And I was talking about that earlier. I mean, you know, you're a trainer. It doesn't matter whether you're a lady or not. You happen to be a wonderful lady, obviously. But I mean, what's the difference being a lady trainer in Australia as opposed to just being a trainer?
Well, I am just a trainer. You're quite right. I dub myself a lady trainer. It's a bit like the Scottish thing, you know. But I just thought I started writing a blog. And so I thought, you know, I had to sort of have a way of talking about myself in it, you know, because it was my day in the life of. So I dubbed myself the lady trainer. It sort of stuck. Uh-huh. But I am a trainer. When I walk on the track, I don't think, am I a woman? Oh, no, I'm not a man. So, you know, when I walk on the track, I don't think what sex I am. I just say, I'm going into bat. This is my job. You know, I've got these horses to work, and we've got a brief to do, and I've got to get it done.
Right. Well, what's the difference between what you've seen here at Saratoga with the American style of racing, emphasis on speed, and the stamina aspect of what you do in Australia?
All right. There's a lot more stamina. It's very interesting. It's an enormous amount of speed. Well, there's an enormous amount of speed in Australia too. Our sires are all about speed. Your sires are all about speed. But the stamina element, it's the horse that can break the gates and have that enormous turn of foot. You know, you're under the pump the moment they jump. Well, that doesn't happen in Australia. We jump, we might have a breather after a furlong or two, you know, a couple of furlongs. In a distance race, a mile plus, they take a cup of tea halfway through the race. I swear to you. You know what I mean? And they all pull up and, hello, what's happening here? And then they take off again. So here it's very much an endurance on the dirt. On the turf, it's a different thing. It's more like Australia. You've got to have that final burst at the end. Whereas it's the strongest man wins that dirt race, and it's very, very impressive, very interesting to watch.
I know you've become friends with Wesley Ward the last few days that you've been here, and I was having a conversation with Wesley after the Preakness, and he was talking to me about having a conversation with the Queen and how the Queen said she was really impressed how Wesley's horses would go to the lead, and she's always fighting with her trainers because they always want to take everything back. And she said, I wish they'd be more like you and just let the horses run, you know? And how is it in Australia? Do people try to like steal races, or is it really more just about the last quarter of a mile?
No, well, most owners and I think most trainers like their horses off the speed. And one very famous trainer and successful trainer in Australia, they had a very big number colt run a few years ago, and my husband Rob said, oh, you know, he ran a nice fourth, and the trainer said, Rob, he's better he runs a nice fourth than he leads and he runs fourth. And that's the thing in people's mind. They can't cope with the horse capitulating. Instead, they'll sooner have the horse running on. Well, I like the horse on the speed because, first, you don't get a any of the dirt in your face if you're on the dirt track. Secondly, you don't get some jockey that loses his compass. And thirdly, you don't get a bump. You know?
That never happens.
I'm going to start using that one. The jockey lost his compass. I got a new line today. I will quote you. We have a lot of those guys. They, I don't even think they bring a compass, some of them.
And the other thing I think is important too is that if a horse is carrying top weight and he's on the speed, he's in those first three, he's not having to carry the weight as long because you're cruising through the race. And interesting, with my husband, who's a bookmaker, he's also a statistician, and he says, and quite rightly so, that 75% of races are won from the turn when you're in that first part of the race. That 75%. So I want to be in that 75% of winners. I don't want to be in the other 25 back of the field that might. It's not a matter of might. The owners are paid a lot of money. They want to win races.
So you and the Queen actually have the same philosophy.
Great. Thanks.
Visiting with Australian Hall of Famer Gay Waterhouse here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Gay, you mentioned when you referred to your father that the key to his success was that his horses were always fit. And when you look back on the way that his training methods was described, there was something that you've told me about this called a bone and muscle method. And just curious, what is the bone and muscle method? What does that mean when we refer to your dad's philosophy?
Well, first of all, Mike, they've got to be fit. So my dad would have the horses, but, you know, extremely fit. And when they went out, they didn't go for a run. They went for, you know, to hit the ground running, and they would win. And he won. The punters adored him. You know, he was TJ. He was. His initials were known in every pub, every club, anywhere you walked. Hi, TJ. Da da da. Everyone knew him. And that, now I've just got a piece of chocolate cake arrived, and I could see the way Mike was looking at this. And I think you should go and ask my husband to do it, because I can. I feel very rude if I have one little nibble on it.
No, you go right ahead. We want you to enjoy yourself.
Gay Waterhouse here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, welcome everybody joining us throughout North America, Sirius 220, XM 206, and everybody streaming us live right now and podcast on our website at horseracingradio.net. Now, Gay, for you, it wasn't always about training horses. There was a time in your life where you did some other things. You were a model. You were an actor. Tell me about that period in your life.
Well, all I wanted to do from when I was a little girl, I'm an only child, and I, you know, your mind sort of wanders a lot because you've got to fill in your days. I didn't go to school till I was 7, so I was the tallest kid in the class, and I was a bit of a difficult child. I would have been an OCD, is that what you call them? You
know, sure.
And so I would have been.
I know that well.
Yeah. So, you know, and I had to repeat a year because I couldn't read or write when I got there. You know, I was a bit of a sort of a like a wild young cult or filly. You know, I just, they hadn't quite mustered me. But the nuns where I went to school obviously saw some sort of, you know, and they bridled that and channeled it. And, you know, I was voted when the year I left school, voted head of the school. But the nuns said, look, we think you've got a little bit too much renegade in you. We better put Dotty Walsh there. So, but, you know, I always wanted to act. And so I went to NIDA, and then I went on from there. I went overseas with my parents and stayed over there. And it was great. Training for me. It taught me to be self-sufficient. It also taught me to be very much believe in myself. It taught me to project my voice and to be able to not be daunted when you see a crowd of owners. You know, I very much thought I've got to get in there and make sure that I convey to them whatever it might be, the disappointment or the success we've had, make them enjoy the moment, even if it's not going to be a winning experience. So it was great for my business.
You have boundless energy. I've been totally amazed by your. I mean, last night you were here. Today you're here. You gave a 2-hour talk this morning. Where does that come from?
I don't know. I'm not working. I'm not getting up at 2:30 in the morning, Jude. So I have a few. My husband, when I said to him, I'm a bit tired, he said, oh, yes, you're getting up at 2:30 in the morning. But of course, I'm not. I'm having to sleep in. So, you know, and I'm here. I'm not under any pressure here at the sales. You know, if we buy something, we buy something. And hopefully, Fezzy Tipton, I will buy something, dear Lord. But, you know, so I'm here on a learning curve, on a sabbatical for 8 days. And so, Jude, I'm not under the same pressure. When at home, I'm under a lot of of pressure, you know.
And you spend a lot of time at the sales looking at yearlings. What is some of the things that Gay Waterhouse is looking for when you're looking at a yearling?
Well, I think probably the same as any of your good agents, trainers, breeders, pin hookers. And I've had the opportunity here, Mike, to get around with different people and just hear what they've got to say and look at different horses. But I just look for the athlete. I look for the horse that when he or she walks out, they sort of grab my attention. They mightn't be perfect, but will that imperfection stop them being champions, stop them being good horses? So that's what I'm trying to look for. I do it very quickly. And, you know, in Australia, if I was buying, as we mainly do in January, at the Magic Million sale, like Fezzy Tipton, very similar sale, I will come back and look again at the horses over a period of maybe 6 to 8 weeks, you know, over a period of time.
How long does it take you once you get them into your stable to know if you've made the right decision?
Well, you soon know. You know, but the thing is, Mike, it's quite interesting. I'll sometimes see a horse and I think to myself, oh, God, I must have been drunk when I bought the horse. You know, it changes and they can become quite like adolescent and gangly and unattractive. But the main thing is interesting, what you see as a yearling, or maybe it's a foal as well, I don't know, but what you see as a yearling invariably comes back as an older horse. So if you love that yearling and there was some beauty in it, invariably it comes back as an older horse. So the biggest thing is for me just to tap, tap, tap into them until I can see where it's going to be a stayer, a sprinter. I don't differentiate with my early training if they're stayers or sprinters. They're just horses going through, you know, getting into the system and getting a feel of them.
So you don't have any preconceived notions. Each one is just an individual, and we're just going to see where
you... I treat them all as two-year-olds till they tell me differently, too. Everything.
When you describe your training method, you often refer to balance and momentum. Talk about that.
Well, if you've got balance, you can get momentum. If you haven't got balance, Mike, you can't get momentum because your legs are going all the right... You know, it's a bit like a cat. If a cat falls off a cliff top or off a window ledge, a cat somehow land on his 4 feet. You know, he's got wonderful agility. Well, that's what you want with the horse. You want with the horse that he can land on his feet and balance him himself. And that's what I'm looking for when I'm watching the yearlings, how they move and things like that, you know.
Only 6 horses in the history of Sydney have won 2-year-old Triple Crowns, and you've trained 2 of those. First of all, what is the 2-year-old Triple Crown in Sydney, and what's the key to the success with the young horses?
You've got to have a horse that is precocious. That's essential. You've got to have a horse that races before December. That's essential. December being, what would that be equivalent to here? When you're yearling, your foals are born in January.
Right,
ours are born
right.
In August.
Okay.
So they've got a race in the early part of the season, even if it's only one run. Usually mine only have one run, and then they go out to the paddock and have a little rest for about a month, and then they come back in. And I want them before January 1st to have won a race, at least won a race. And then I'll start to sort out what could be the Golden Slipper horse. The Golden Slipper is a $4.5 million Australian dollar race. It's run in Sydney, it's run over 6 furlongs, and it is the stallion-making race of Australia. All our main stallions have won that race. And then the race that follows a week later is a sire's produce of 7 furlongs, and then it used to run a week after, 3 weeks in a row, the 1600, 8 furlong. So you'd have 6 furlongs, 7 furlongs, 8 furlongs, one Saturday, next Saturday, and the Saturday after.
Wow. Wow, you don't see that here in the States.
No, you do not.
Well, what do you think about that? The way that everybody here babies the horses, and you know, once every 2 months maybe we'll run them, and they don't do that other places. They didn't used to do that here,
no.
But it's changed quite a bit now, where people don't run their horses as often, and there's all kinds of scuttlebutt. What they blame it on different things, but what's your philosophy with running those horses back quickly?
This is only my opinion. But I'm sure it's the Lasix. And by backing, you can't back your horse up because he loses too much body weight with the Lasix. Now, if he doesn't have that, which we don't have in Australia, and you find that the horse can't, I mean, they've got it in Australia, but I don't use it because I want my horse to be able to back up if that's the program for the horse. I had a mare run last week, and the week before she ran over 7 furlongs and ran a nice fourth or fifth. I thought, you haven't got quite fit. And I said to the owners, I want to back her up next week in the 8 furlong, the mile race. And they said, oh, you know, and I said, look, I'm telling you, it's on your home track. You don't want to be stuck in the box. Let her run. Of course, she wins. She leads all the way and wins. Now, her mother was a very bold front-running mare that ran up to 2 miles. She ran second in the Sydney Cup. And this mare just might, given the opportunity.
So you, even at your elevated status, you still have to argue with clients.
Yeah. They don't last long with me if we argue. I want them to have a happy relationship. They're paying me to do a job. They're paying for my expertise. But I'm very open to their comment and their thoughts because they're paying the bill. And they make, I always say, two heads are better than one. But at the end of the day, the final decision, there's got to be one captain. Now, if they say to me, we want to run in that race, I don't think it's the right way to go, I will give my case. But if they say, okay, we don't want to do that, at the end of the day, Jude, that's their horse. And I will then get my mind around it and make sure that I try to produce what they want.
Now, you won, is it 6 runnings of the Golden Slipper? Is that right, Gay?
I've won 6 Golden Slippers, the most in Australia.
Yeah.
I won it with 2 fillies and 1 gelding and 3 colts.
And am I right in saying that that equals your father's mark in that race?
Yes, it does, Mike, yes.
What does that mean to you?
Oh, it was fantastic. It happened this year with Vancouver, the Magliadori colt, and it was fantastic. I never thought I'd do it. It just blew me away. And I think everyone was really genuinely happy for me, though. It's really nice. It was a lovely feeling. Around the track and everywhere, you know, it was really nice.
Do you kind of get the sense that, you know, maybe your dad was there with you?
I think
when
so.
You equal that?
He certainly would have been saying you're improved.
Yeah, he was kind of tough on you. When we had you on last night, you were talking about, and he was not the easiest on you as far as, like, I know he was supportive, but he kind of gave you a hard time sometimes.
Oh, he did, Jude. He was very outspoken, but he was right. He was very, he'd tell you exactly. You know, if you weren't doing something right, he'd tell you. But you want that. You know, what's the point? If you're on the radio and blah, 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 Fezzy Tipton will say, come on, get that girl off the boom, boom, want to put so-and-so on. You know, it's the same. You know, Dad was good. He would see what I was doing wrong, and he could tell me immediately because he knew. So that's what a father should be doing and helping.
What do you think he would say if he were here today and he could see all of your success?
Oh, he'd be very proud. He'd be very proud, Mike. But he'd say, look, go and do X, Y, Z. Come on, go and find that new client over there. Don't do wasting there. Blah, blah, blah. God, thought it, he'd be very...
Well, I think that's what makes the great trainers great, even the ones we've visited with on this program over the past couple of years. You know, the likes of a Bob Baffert or a Bill Mott, they never rest on their laurels. There's always that next goal ahead, and even with everything they've accomplished, they're always looking to the future.
Very much so, and that's the industry of that. You know, it's an industry that's constantly evolving and constantly moving forward, and people want tomorrow's. You know, it's the dream. We are selling the dream of winning the Breeders' Cup, to winning the Golden Slipper or the Melbourne Cup, or you know, Wesley went to, you know, I was watching the photograph of the Coolmore boys down in one of the barns, and you know, there they were at Ascot this year, and of course an American bred horse wins it. Fantastic. It's a dream.
Right.
We're going to continue this visit with Gay Waterhouse in the second half of the program. Have to get to a short commercial break. We'll come back and look back on so many of those great horses that she's had the privilege to be around. We'll do that next. It's Trainer Talk presented by Fezzik Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Fezzik Tipton November sale annually posts the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. Over the past 10 years, 142 fillies and mares have brought prices over $1 million, and 3 world records have been broken. Last year, the Fezzik Tipton November sale sold 23 seven-figure fillies and mares, more than any other mixed sale in the world, with an average sale price far greater than our nearest competitor. The world's premier breeding stock event, November 1st, 2015 at Fezzik Tipton. Where will you be?
And they're off to New York, the premier state-bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The
best program.
Millridge has developed a stellar reputation for raising and selling racehorses and will be offering 7 quality yearlings at the upcoming Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale, representing 6 different stallions: Congrats, Distorted Humor, Elusive Quality, Quality Road, Pioneer of the Nile, and Trap Shot. Since 2005, Millridge has offered 45 yearlings at the Saratoga sale, with 66% winners, 4.5% grade 1 or grade 2 winners, 16% graded placed, and 24% stakes placed. Millridge, raising and selling racehorses.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Welcoming everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM 206, and those of you tuning in with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, if you did miss any portion of this show, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can listen online at your leisure. That is also available for you on iTunes as well. Just search Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. But we are enjoying this visit with the legendary Australian Hall of Famer, Gay Waterhouse. And Jude, we had the opportunity to hear so many of the stories that she told us in the first half of the program with growing up, and now we can look ahead to so many of the horses that have indeed helped make her legendary.
Well, countless champions.
Yeah.
Let's get to it.
Saddled her very first winner on March 15th, 1992. It was a horse by the name of Gifted Poet. And when you think back on that day, Gay, what comes to mind?
It was so funny. I had a little stable, one of Dad's, and these guys walked in, really big, bulky guys, and they were police officers. And they said, "We want to give you a horse." I said, "Hang on." And I ran into the feed room and I rang my husband. Now, why would I just open the gun and say, "I'll take your horse"? And I said, "Robbie, do the form on Gifted Poet." And within a second, he said, "Look, he's quite a handy provincial horse, but you'll improve him." I'm lucky I've got the men around me are very supportive. So I came up and said, "Yes, I'd love to train your horse." And then, of course, I didn't run him for about 3 months. And everyone kept saying, "What's the matter with you? You know, why haven't you run this horse?" I said, "I'll run him when I can win with him. I want to make a statement. I don't want the horse just to run. I want to win with him." So I waited. When I thought I could win with him, and I didn't know how to train, you know, even though I'd been with my father, I'd never been tested. Anyway, he started at a provincial track and he won first up. And then the next week they had a Sunday meeting. So 8 days later, I ran him again and he won in town, the first Sunday meeting we had. Anyway, then I had someone else gave me another horse. Anyway, for the first 5 horses I started, they all won because I knew unless I kicked a few goals, people would say, "Oh, she can't train." I had to show to people that I could train and that I knew what I was doing. Now, I didn't know what I was doing. I just happened to have a gut feeling, and I suppose I was observant with the horses and could just see, you know, how they pulled up after the race and one thing and another.
Well, it's quite remarkable when you look at the accomplishments that you've had, and just going back to your first runners, how about these statistics? Gay's first runner in a race won, as you just heard, Gifted Poet. Her first runner in a Metropolitan race won. Her first runner in a Group 1 race won, and her first runner in a jumps race won. Think about that. Well, these first runners are pretty good to you.
Oh, yeah. They are. I only took out jump training about 2 years ago, and I must say I really enjoy it. It's not big in Australia. It's not even in New South Wales. And my father hates jump racing, maybe because he broke his hip over the jumps years ago. But I enjoy it, and I think it's a very nice life for a horse after. Now, not all my owners agree with that, but the ones that do – look, they go down to Warrnambool, which is on it's between South Australia and Victoria. So it's right on the border. It's very cold this time of year. But we go for 5,500 meter. What's that? That's about 2.5 miles over the jumps they go. And they love it, the horses. They're going slow. They're not as big as what you see over in Aintree and you know, in England. But it just gives the horses another life. And, you know, the prize money for some of those, like the grand annuals, $250,000, and some of the races are $100,000, and the others, of course, are smaller purses of $20,000. So I start off small, and then I try to get to the $100,000 race as quickly as I can to pay all the extras for the horses and the owners.
How is the purse structure in Australia? I mean, can an owner do relatively well? Are the purses...
They are. I was talking with someone yesterday, June. It was very interesting. I think probably more consistent in Australia, but your purses are very high here. They're very high in America. But I suppose consistently through the board, it's a very nice, you know, you're racing for $27,000 on a Wednesday in a metropolitan. You're running for $22,000 at the provincials. You know, you're running for $85,000 to $100,000 every Saturday. You know, and then you've got the things like I was talking to one of the consigners about the New York, you know, what we'd call a bonus race. Well, we've got these bonuses in each of the different states. They've got the Bob's bonus and the Curus bonus. And they go with, if you win a race in that state, you get a bonus. So that to the owners is a huge kick along. And they can either take it as the cash, like the money or the box, you know, Bob Dye, you can either take it as the cash or you can put it towards a horse and pays for your next horse.
Oh, that's interesting.
Wow. Good, isn't it?
Wow. There have been so many milestones in your career, Gay. Tell us about some of the other horses that when you think back on your career that you're just, for whatever reason, never going to forget.
Well, Dance Hero was a horse I had enormous. I enjoyed it hugely. Maybe Mum had a share in him, so that I paid $90,000 for him at the yearling sales, like a Fizzy Tipton sale. And I offered him to a syndicator, and they didn't want him. And as a two-year-old, he was a little bit sort of open in his knees, so we gelded him. In those days, you did geld horses. Nowadays, you don't. And he won the Triple Crown. So we raced him in the Golden Slipper, and he got his nostril in front on the post. And then he came out the week after and won the Sire's Produce, and then he came out and won the Champagne Stakes. And you know, Mum was so sweet that she had this little four-leaf clover, and every so often, well, not every time he ran, she'd produce it at the races.
She was a hoot. So she was a big racing fan, obviously.
She was so sweet. Mike, she used to say, I used to be known as Tommy Smith's wife, but now I'm known as Gay Waterhouse's mother.
that's great. I mean, that's fantastic. You're here. And you're kind of incognito. And I know Yutaka Take, the Japanese jockey, he used to love coming to the United States because nobody knew who he was. In Japan, he was like Michael Jordan, and everywhere he went, people wanted autographs, and they were swarming him. And I'm sure it's similar for you in Australia. Everybody knows who you are. They knew who your father was. They know who you are. So you come here, and you can just be yourself and nobody knows.
Absolutely.
Are you enjoying that?
I'm adoring it. But I did put my red hat on today because I had to give the talk this morning and I thought they better know who they're looking at. So I put a red hat on. I thought, well, then they say, oh, there she is. There's Gay. You know?
Why the red hat?
Well, I was coming over here and I like to wear hats. I get quite sunburned. I've got quite fair skin and I get quite sunburned from the sun and I get cold sores. So I always wear a hat. And when coming over here, I thought, now I'm going to make sure I get a couple of – go to a hat maker, and Neil and I, you know, shoot the breeze trying to decide different things for different race meetings. And I'm known for my hats. And so I thought, if I'm coming here, it's important that I wear some different hats. So I bought a drum box right now. This is what the ladies listening to this show should – years ago when I went to Royal Ascot, I thought, I don't want to be taking a whole lot of different hat boxes. So I bought a drum case and I took a tour that year of about, there were about 20 people, there were about 10 ladies. And I said to them, it costs $250, go and buy yourself a drum hat box, which we all ended up at Heathrow Airport with drum boxes. They thought I was a band leader.
Visiting with Gay Waterhouse here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Gay, let's go back to your very first Group 1 winner, which also came in that very first year of training in 1992. Tell me about that day.
Well, that was the horse I mentioned earlier, yeah. Tiako Nick. And David Ellis sent him over, and he was a real wiry gelding. New Zealand is and was the best place to buy stayers. Very much like Ireland and England, a colder climate, and the horse matures more slowly. And so all, if you look in Australia, any mile plus races, 1600 metre plus, bet your bottom dollar it's either a New Zealand NZ suffix or now English, Irish, European. The Aussie horse very rarely wins that race with the 1600 metre plus. So we're speed horses, and they sent me this horse to train. And on the day, he was short price favourite. And I remember walking off the track and thinking, oh gosh, I hope I can pull this off. And Rob said to me, he says, don't worry about it. He said, like when I won the Melbourne Cup, He said, you got the right horse, you're in the right place, just get on and do it. And that's what happened with Ferrante, you know, in 2013.
Yeah, Ferrante, very special. Tell me his story.
Well, it was very interesting. Rob said to me about 5 years ago, he said, we've got to start looking overseas in England for stayers. And I said, what are we going to do? He said, well, you've got to raise $1 million. How do you like that? I'm a breakfast, raise $1 million. So I said, all right. So I set to with my racing manager, Adrian Bott, and he'd ring the owners, and we told them the concept. We'd go to the Tattersall sale, you know, and like the stayers sale for Fezzy Tipton. You like that, Fezzy Tipton? So we go over there, and we go to the sale. It's in November. And we had $1 million. Now, Rob then sits down and does the form on the whole of the catalogue. I think it's like you have a lot of horses go through. And he identified certain horses on form. Then he had a man look at their gaits. So one of the guys that works with him would watch all the videos of the horse's action. And we got down to maybe, I don't know, how many horses. And people said, oh, what's the horse buying out of? I say, it's cup out of saucer. I don't care what it's buyer out of. As long as Rob likes it on form and they've passed it and the vet's passed it, that's the horse we should run with. Well, I can't tell you the Group 1 horses we've bought that way. But we go over there and we're looking. We'd been in France and I thought, I don't know, my eye must be gone. I can't find a decent horse that I saw there. You know, there were plenty of good horses, but they were out of our price range. And we went to England. We were at the July meeting and we were standing under the trees and the horse walked around. It was Ferrante. And then he won the group race that day. And I said to Rob, there's the horse. I said, that's the horse I want to train. And we went over straight away. We got an agent and went over and asked straight away. We offered £700,000 for the horse on the spot. I said, don't be ridiculous. We're going on to the Prix de l'Arctic Trail. That's run in October, so we said, fair enough. £700,000 out the window. And we sat on the fence. And there were a number of Australians on the horse. Anyway, we went into bat, and we happened to have the agent that was in the right place at the right time. And they accepted our offer, which we had to up. And we got the horse. He came to Australia that November. Quarantine in Australia is quite tricky. It's 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. So you have to quarantine in the country where you are, and then you have quarantine for another 2 weeks in Australia. And he was just out of Melbourne, and the Cups run in Melbourne. And so you have to train them from the quarantine station. He came in that day. They leave the quarantine on the day of the race, and he came to Flemington, and he ran second. We won $900,000 that day. That paid his purchase price. So we sent him again the next year, and we set him for the Cup. I only gave him very light autumn, gave him one race, put him away, gave him a spell, and brought him back. We got ready for the Cup. And he won the Cup, and it was a dream. It was an absolute, like winning the Breeders' Plate or the Breeders' Cup. It was a dream come true.
Yeah, and joined some very elite company that day, right? I guess the Carbine and Farlap, both legendary thoroughbreds in Australia, he joined them in terms of being able to do that and pull off that feat in the Melbourne Cup.
Very much so. I mean, Carbine's one of the great, through Carbine, so much of our breeding has taken place in Australia. And, of course, Tullock and all those horses, were there. But it was very exciting to have Ferrante win. And, you know, in that ownership of that horse, you'll never guess how many people, but I'll tell you, 32 people owned Ferrante. And there were so many people, I was trying to get them all up on the podium after the race. And the chairman of the VRC, his wife, said, yay, you can't put any more people on the podium, you'll break it. I said, well, wouldn't that be wonderful for racing?
That is one of the beauties of the partnership thing, is so many people can participate, and some of those partnership groups become great friends and continue their relationships outside of racing. And I think it's a great thing for our sport.
Very important for our sport. Very important to bring people into the sport because it's affordable. You know, for a certain amount of dollars, you can have a share in a horse. Most of the partnerships in Australia are about 20 people nowadays, and all their names are in the book, and it's really important. And I see you've got a few syndicators here, and they do a very good job. And the biggest thing is to bring people into the race. Like, people buy Mother's Day presents of a share in a horse, a birthday present, an engagement present, you know, something like that. It's just lovely. It's a lovely way to get people into racing. And most of my biggest owners have come through syndicates.
Yeah, that's another thing that people don't realize, is somebody will get their feet wet and they have the wherewithal to spend more money or to have their own horses. And it just takes a little push, a little getting used to what's going on. Because a lot of people don't want to just like make a big investment right off the bat. I mean, they want to learn the game a little bit and maybe find a trainer that suits them. And so you can do that through a partnership, whereas, you know, otherwise you're kind of rolling the dice.
Well, you don't know what to do, do you? Yeah. I mean, racing, we talk a different language. And so they come here and they talk about this, that, and the other, and fetlocks and, you know, rumps and tails and 6 furlongs and that. And I think, what are they talking about?
Yep.
They join a partnership that usually the syndicators will explain on the way. It's a bit of a ride and a bit of a journey. And you're quite right, Jude. There are lots of friendships made. I open the stables every Sunday for my owners. And between 11 and 12, we have all the horses are shown of any of the owners that turn up. And Dad taught me that. He said, don't have your owners coming to the stables whenever they want to. He said, because you'll break the routine of your yard and disturb your horses. Just have one day that they know they can come, and they come every Sunday. And while the horses are in, it's a real, oh, hi, hi, Mike, hi, Jude, yeah, hi. And we all have a drink after, and we watch the replays and talk. And then by 1 o'clock, they've all gone. You know, it's nice. It's really nice.
That's cool. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it is a great idea and a great way to bring people into this great game. Gay, when you think back on your career, what are some of the things that you're going to be most proud of?
My most proud of having two great kids, Tom and Kate, and that really should never be overlooked, because firstly, you know, I am a mum, you know, I'm a wife first and a mum, and you know, they've been very supportive of me, and they give me great joy, and we have a lot of laughs, and they take the mickey out of mum in no uncertain terms. I'm very, very knockable, believe me. The cartoonists have great fun with me. But no, they're great, and then they're always wanting to know what's happening, and now I've got two grandchildren, about to have a third. Well, my daughter-in-law's about to have a third. I'm not, thank God. And you know, that's a great interest. And we bought a little farm just out of Sydney just last year, and Rob wanted to buy that because we called it Ferente.
Oh, cool.
Oh, great.
And it's to bring all of us together as a family so we can enjoy the kids growing up. And what are the things I enjoy most? I just love it that I like to give pleasure to people. I think that's one of the things that I most enjoy. I love training. I'm extremely competitive. Hi, how are you going? I'm extremely competitive. But I enjoy seeing people get a kick out of it. That gives me a kick because, you know, that's why they really come into racing, most people.
Jude, you mentioned the energy that Gay has. And if people are – obviously when they're listening to this, they're going to pick up on that energy. It's 100% true. Is it true also, Gay, that you were once pickpocketed in Rome?
Oh, that's very funny.
Where do you come up with this?
How do you found that one? I never know.
Was that on Wikipedia?
Yeah, that was on Wikipedia.
It's true, though, isn't it?
Isn't it? Well, I wasn't. Rob has very long pockets. Now, that doesn't mean that he's mean. Being a bookmaker, he learned long ago that if his pockets were long, if he put any cash in his pockets, it was much harder for people to get it out, namely pickpockets. So Rob's got these long pockets. Right? And so we're in Rome, and he had in one hand, he had a little macchiato, a little coffee, and in the other, he had his dry cleaning. We were walking through Rome. It's a dangerous place at the best of place, and a very pretty girl got in front of Rob, and Rob, being a normal guy, looked at her and was eyeing her off. Next minute, he could feel something on the side of his pants, and of course he realized immediately that someone was trying to pick his pocket, and he turned quickly and tossed the macchiato, the coffee, in the guy's face, and of course he skittled off and the girl evaporated. I thought that'll teach him getting his eyes off.
That's great. No, it's a great story, and by the way, that is actually all the information is posted there on your website, so it was very easy to go back and find that, as well as your loyal dog named Bello. Is that right? Is Bello still around?
Bello's well and truly. Yeah. Rob gave him to me as a present, and he's a mixture of a poodle. I love poodles, and I've had a lot of poodles, but Rob said, no more poodles. He said, we're poodled out. He said, choose another dog. So we went around some of the doggy places, you know, where people breed the dogs, and he wanted a big dog. But my mother was still alive, and she was quite frail, and I thought if the big dog jumps on her, he might push her in the pool. We don't want that happening. So I looked at the big dog, and I said, no. So all of a sudden we saw a poodle cross some – he's not a poodle quadoodle or whatever you call them, but he's like a terrier poodle, and his name's Bello the Beautiful, and he goes everywhere. He's around the stables. He comes to the track in the morning. He sits in the tower, and everyone knows Bello. He's great. He's about 4 years old, and he's a very kind dog.
That's cool. It's great when you have a dog around the horses. And a lot of racetracks here don't allow dogs on the backside. Santa Anita is one that does. And Charlie Whittingham always used to have his dogs around the barn. It was quite nice.
It's very popular in England, too. And you see a lot of lurchers and dogs around the barn. Look, I think that the more around the horse, one of my main stable, Tullock Lodge, has got 77 horses in there, and right next door to Tullock Lodge, literally next door, is a school of about 100 and something kids screaming and yelling and carrying on. And people say, oh, do the horses worry about the noise? The horses are completely oblivious to the noise because that's what they've been used to all their life. And we walk out of Tullock Lodge and Barrel Street, our street, that we have to walk up to get onto the track. There's, you know, two-way traffic going up, and of course all the parking on the other side. It's really, you take your life in your hands. And we walk two horses abreast. So you walk and lead one, you know, or we'll ride and lead one, not from Tullock Lodge. We do that on track. But, you know, we've got to get those horses from the stables walked every day, morning and afternoon. So logistically, I have to get them out of the stables and on the track. So we walk them in pairs. A lot of people laugh, you know, because it's different to
yeah. Yeah, the story is just incredible. And this entire visit tonight has certainly been incredible, Gay. If there was anything that if you were to go back and do everything all over again, is there anything you might do differently?
I don't know. Probably not. You know, it's hard to sort of think. I think the most important thing is you've got to be patient. I think you've got to time and patience is a great thing with horses. And if you're a bit patient with them, often you can get a surprise package. You know, if they're all apparent that they're going to be buying a champion, then the only Coolmore or Dali or the big studs would own them. But because there's that lovely element of unpredictability and also that element of horses can change, you know, that's the lovely thing about racing. You might buy a plain Jane that ends up being, not the ugly duckling, but a beautiful swan. And that's the lovely thing about racing.
What's still motivating Gay Waterhouse?
Well, I like going to the track every morning. I like going out and training my horses. I enjoy the experience of I enjoy the training part. I really like that, Mike, you know. I like the team situation I'm in. I've got 100 people I work with, and I like that team situation. You know, I'm a bit of a school mistress, as I said to you before, and I get a lot of kids come to me, and I like training them as well. So I get enormous enjoyment out of all those things.
What do you like to do when you're not at the track?
Oh, goof off. Yeah. I get home and I take my shoes off at the front door and I put my slippers on and my, you know, my daggy tracksuit pants, and I just goof around. And then on a Saturday night, my girlfriend has just walked in, Leah and her husband, and Rob and I, and usually a couple of other people, maybe four or six of us, go to dinner on a Saturday night and chew the cud, as I call it, and have a drink and let down. That's really fun. I enjoy that.
So it's just a normal life. Getting to a normal life is your entertainment.
Well, we take two breaks a year, which is unlike most people in this sport. We took our school holidays in Australia in June, July for the kids, and November, December. That's your long break, is in November through the end of November through to January. That's our long break, like your summer break. And every single year of our married life, and my parents used to come with us when they were alive, we would head off somewhere overseas, always overseas, to either America or over to Europe, and we would go for a month away with the kids. And that was our time away to be with them the whole time, and be it skiing or going to a beach thing or going somewhere where we could learn something. And so, and we still do it, even though they've gone on their way and sometimes join us. We still do it, Rob and I, every year. Twice a year we go away.
That's great.
You know, we talked about so many of the champions that Gay has had the privilege to be around as well. And there's one horse in particular that I know you're very fond of. And we really haven't spent much time talking about him, but that's Vancouver. Tell me a little bit about Vancouver.
Vancouver's a very, very interesting horse because he's by an American sire that came to Australia. And it was his first crop. And no one really cottoned on what a serious sire Magliadori is. And he was consigned by Coolmore, but bred by a man called John Camilleri, who's very big in Australian breeding, but he's a boutique breeder. So when I saw with Leah, we would go around all the studs together. It takes us, you know, a couple of months to get through them. We got to the Coolmore draft, which was about 60-something yearlings. You know, it's awesome. Anyway, he comes out, and he didn't blow me away, but he was a nice, loose sort of horse. And he had this J on his shoulder because they're all branded. They're all tattooed in Australia, so they've got the brands. And that tells you, one, the foal number from that date on one side, and on the other side is a brand that might tell you the stud or the consigner, and that you look at that and then you can tell. It's quite good. So anyway, I saw the J and I knew that was John Camilleri's horse, and it's out of a multiple group one winning mare called Skates. And she was getting a bit what we call long in the tooth. She was getting a bit old. I don't like buying from old mares because I don't think they're as they're not like a young mare. Young mare's got all the apparatus in place. It's got the good blood flow to the foal. It's got a lovely, you know, muscle tone around the foal. I want all that. But in the older mare, they don't have as much of that. Anyway, that was against it. But when we saw it again in the sale, it had done really well. And he reminded me a bit of Sebring, another multiple Australasian champion two-year-old that won the Golden Slipper. I thought, you're a bit loose, you know. He went for 185,000. If he'd gone for 385,000, I wouldn't have owned him. I wouldn't have bought him. So I bought him on spec, and then I ring my owners. I'm not a pin hooker. I'm a horse trainer, but I use my expertise to say to my owners, I think you should come into this horse. And some came in immediately, others ummed and ahed, and about five of us ended up owning Vancouver. Vancouver was bought for 185,000 and sold 6 months ago for $40 million Australian. And that's a success story in Australia. That's remarkable.
And there's been so many of those success stories in the career of Gay Waterhouse. And Gay, we can't thank you enough for spending a little time with us here. Of course, people won't realize that Gay is an Australian living treasure, is nominated by the National Trust of Australia. And she has been a treasure on this Trainer Talk program here tonight. And Gay, really do appreciate it. And continued success moving forward. Safe trip back to Australia. It's been a delight.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Jude, for having me on the show.
Thank you.
All right. And Gay Waterhouse here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you did miss any portion of the show, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. A podcast of the show will be available later on this evening, and you can listen at your leisure. You can also do that by going to Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Really enjoyable.
Fantastic.
That's all you have to say is fantastic.
I'm speechless.
It was tremendous, and we really do appreciate everybody being with us here tonight. Sirius 220, XM 206 is where you can find us every single Wednesday evening. All of this Trainer Talk programming presented by our friends here at Fasig Tipton. And we want to thank everybody, Max Hodge, for helping us set this up, and, of course, Anna Seitz as well for everything that she did. And
Boyd Browning.
The
magnificent.
Look at that. Waiting for a little shout-out there. El Presidente. It's been a lot of fun. For our producer, Lee Delapina, back in our Lexington studio, for Jude Feld, and our thanks to Gay Waterhouse for an amazing hour. We hope you enjoyed it, and thanks for being with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. I'm Mike Penna. So long.